Good morning, Mendocino. This is Jeff Blankford, welcoming you to the August 22nd edition of Takes on the World, a public affairs program that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month. And every other fifth Wednesday, when I open the phones to you, our listeners, which will be the case next Wednesday, August 29th. On August 10th, 2 days after my last program, a headline in the New York Times caught my eye. It read, quote, 4 decades on, U.S. starts cleanup of Agent Orange in Vietnam. From Da Nang in Vietnam, a name that will bring back memories of those who fought in that war and those who opposed it, The Times' Thomas Fuller writes, quote, in the tropical climate of central Vietnam, weeds and shrubs seem to grow everywhere, except here. 40 years after the United States stopped spraying herbicides in the jungles of Southeast Asia in the hopes of denying cover to Viet Cong fighters and North Vietnamese troops, an air base here is one of about 24 former American sites that remain polluted with an especially toxic strain of dioxin, the chemical containment in Agent Orange that has been linked to cancers, birth defects, and other diseases. On Thursday, August 9th, he goes on, after years of rebuffing Vietnamese request for assistance in a cleanup, the United States inaugurated its first major effort to address the environmental effects of the long war. This morning, we celebrate a milestone in our bilateral relationship. He quotes David Scheer, the American ambassador to Vietnam, as saying at a ceremony attended by senior officers of the Vietnamese military, we're cleaning up this mess. That cleanup is expected to cost $43 million and take 4 years. While officially welcomed with smiles and handshakes at the ceremony, bitterness remains, writes Fuller. Agent Orange is mentioned often in the Vietnamese news media, and its victims are commemorated annually on August 10th, the day in 1961 when American forces first began spraying it over Vietnam. The Vietnamese government objected to Dow Chemical, the leading producer of Agent Orange, being a sponsor of the London Olympics, as did India, since Dow took over Union Carbide, where a toxic gas leak was responsible for an estimated 8,000 deaths in 1984. It was clearly an understatement. The New York Times Fuller noted that many Vietnamese have not hesitated to call the American program too little. It addresses only this one site, and that it comes very late. Over a decade of war, the United States sprayed about 20 million gallons of Agent Orange and other herbicides in Vietnam, Cambodia, and Laos, halting only after scientists commissioned by the Agriculture Department issued a report expressing concerns that dioxin showed, quote, a significant potential to increase birth defects, end quote. By the time the spraying stopped, Agent Orange and other herbicides had destroyed 2 million hectares or 5.5 million acres of forest and cropland, an area roughly the size of New Jersey. From beginning to end, the U.S. involvement in Vietnam was a succession of war crimes. Yet only Lieutenant Calley, charged with the murder of 22 Vietnamese in My Lai, served time in prison. Today at half past the hour, in a variation from my usual schedule, I'm going to be speaking with someone who has spent considerable time dealing with the use by the U.S. government of Agent Orange in Vietnam. That would be Professor Marjorie Cohn of Thomas Jefferson School of Law, the former president of the National Lawyers Guild, and a member of the board of the Vietnam Agent Orange Relief and Responsibility Campaign. Because of her teaching schedule, she could only be with us from 9:30 to 9:45, so stay tuned for that. From approximately 20 minutes past the hour until I get to her on the phone, I'll be providing an update on the negotiations between the county supermarkets, Safeway, Raley's, and Lucky, and their workers who have been on the job without a new contract since last year, and hearing from United Food and Commercial Workers Local 5 President Ron Lynn speaking to the workers at Safeway and Lucky, and from Tara McMillan, a worker at Lucky. In the meantime, while we wait to hear about the deadly legacy of one war, let's look at the efforts being made by another generation of criminals to get us into two more. Let's start with Iran. While some may argue that the Israel lobby doesn't control the media, they certainly control the message. No better example for this can be found than on the op-ed pages of the New York Times and the Washington Post last Friday. By an extraordinary coincidence, two key members of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, or WINEP, a think tank founded by AIPAC in 1985 for situations such as this, had opinion pieces telling President Obama what he, and by implication, the United States must do for Israel in order to keep it from attacking Iran before November's elections. The most well-known of these warmongers was Dennis Ross, who has served in the administration of every president since George Bush Sr., and who, despite resigning from the Obama administration, maintains a direct phone line between his office at Winnep and the White House. In other words, what he put into the New York Times for the world to see could have been communicated directly to President Obama by picking up the phone. And he no doubt would have done that had he not wanted outside pressure on the president during the run-up to the elections. His article was called, quote, "How America Can Slow Israel's March to War," end quote. Not stop it, mind you, just slow it down till next year. How can the president do it? Ross's solution. Give Israel more weapons, including, quote, bunker buster bombs, tanks for refueling aircraft, and targeting information. And finally, the White House should ask Mr. Netanyahu what sort of support he would need from the United States if he chose to use force. For example, resupply of weapons, munitions, spare parts, military and diplomatic backing, and help in terms of dealing with unexpected contingencies. The United States, writes Ross, should be prepared to make firm commitments in all these areas now in return for Israel's agreement to postpone any attack until next year, a delay that could be used to exhaust diplomatic options and lay the groundwork for military action if diplomacy failed, end quote. In so many words, Ross is telling the President of the United States to ask to follow the example of Mitt Romney and turn his Middle East policy over to Benjamin Netanyahu, the prime minister of a foreign country who has been labeled a nutcase by some former Israeli generals and intelligence chiefs who oppose an attack on Iran. Ross is something worse than a nutcase by quite openly putting what he perceives to be Israel's national interests before those of his country's. He exposes himself as a traitor, where in Washington, sadly, they can be found by the dozens. That's something that separates him from the author of the other op-ed piece, the one in the Washington Post, retired Major General Amos Eidlin, a former chief of Israeli military intelligence and presently director of Israel's Institute for National Security Affairs. What's curious is that there's no mention at the end of his article that he has been a fellow of AIPAC's Washington Institute since officially retiring from Israeli government service in November of 2010. I say officially retiring because everyone involved at the Washington Institute can be said to be de facto working for the Israeli government. Whereas Ross's op-ed piece broke his suggestions down into three steps, Yadlin proposes, quote, five steps Obama can take to avert a strike on Iran, end quote. Before introducing his five steps, he wants the Post readers to know that, quote, a long-standing principle of Israeli defense doctrine is that it will never ask the United States to fight for it. That is why Israel's political leaders have emphasized that when it comes to national security, Israel will ultimately decide and act on its own. Unfortunately, what Israeli leaders may not fully grasp, he writes, is that while they can attack alone, Israel will need the United States both the day after and the decade after a strike to ensure that Iran does not reconstitute its program. Disregarding U.S. requests to delay would not encourage such support. Only by framing a nuclear-armed Iran, he says, as an impermissible threat to the national interest of the United States and its allies in the Persian Gulf can President Obama bridge this gap between Israeli creed and need, end quote. That's Israel and the Washington Institute's Amos Yadlin. When you break it down, he's saying the U.S. should be ready and willing to clean up Israel's mess in Iran for the 10 years following Israel's attack, and that can only be done by military action, which, as the general knows quite well, means another war and sacrifices by Americans for Israel. He goes on again, quote, the U.S. president should visit Israel and tell its leadership, and more important, its people, that preventing a nuclear war is a U.S. interest, and if we have to resort to military action, we will. This message, he says, delivered by the President of the United States to the Israeli Knesset, will be far more effective than U.S. officials' attempts to convey the same sentiment behind closed doors, end quote. In other words, Obama must personally make a journey to Israel and kiss Netanyahu's boots, just as in Romney, and just as does all but a handful of members of the United States Congress. But that's just the beginning. First, Yadlin writes that he has to tell Congress, Obama that is, that he will use military force to prevent Iran from achieving nuclear weapons capability. Not actually building a weapon, but just being able to do so. We can guess who will determine that and what language he will be speaking. Second, although the U.S. and its allies currently surround Iran, it's not enough. More U.S. missiles and military deployments must be made in the immediate region. Third, quote, Washington should provide advanced military technology and intelligence to strengthen Israel's military capabilities and extend the window in which Israel can mortally wound Iran's program. End quote. That's if Israel gives sanctions more time to work. In other words, like Ross, like Netanyahu, he's in the extortion racket. Pay up or we start bombing tomorrow. Fourth, goes on Yadlin, the Obama administration has to warn about the dangers of Iran rebuilding its nuclear program after being attacked. Otherwise, Yadlin believes, quote, we will quickly lead to the disintegration of Western sanctions, end quote. He's right there. The rest of the world's countries, including America's allies, are only going along with the sanctions against Iran out of fear that they, their banks and their corporations, will be sanctioned by Israel's Washington proxy if they don't. That's the truth that our leaders in Israeli-occupied Washington and its media stable won't tell us, and that goes for most of the alternative media as well. Yadlin's fifth and final prescription for the president makes it clear. Obama must be ready to sacrifice American lives and our national economy on Israel's behalf. Obama, he writes, should publicly commit to the security of U.S. allies in the Gulf. This would reassure jittery friends in the region and credibly anchor the U.S. last resort military option to three powerful interests, U.S. national security, Israeli security, and the security of allied states, end quote. Now, what were you saying, General Yadlin, about Israel, quote, never asking the United States to fight for it? Well, Yadlin is nothing if not persistent. In the March 1st New York Times, whose op-ed pages, like those of the Washington Post and the Wall Street Journal, are always open to hardline Israelis, he wrote on the same theme, what's needed from President Obama is an ironclad American assurance that if Israel refrains from acting on its in its own window of opportunity, and all other options have failed to halt Tehran's nuclear quest, Washington will act to prevent a nuclear Iran while it is still within its power to do so. I hope Mr. Obama will make this clear, he writes. If he does not, Israeli leaders may well choose to act while they still can, end quote. Yadlin did not need to add the U.S. Congress will support Israel, whatever Netanyahu chooses to do. Thanks to the purging of the so-called Arabists from Capitol Hill that began under Bill Clinton, there's no open debate on Washington on this issue, and nothing seems to be standing in Israel's way. There's much more to say about Iran, but let's move on to Syria, where, what's this? Another branch of the pro-Israel establishment, chicken hawks one and all, is cheerleading for another war. Bill Kristol's foreign policy initiative, the self-proclaimed successor to the Project for New American Century, has put out a list of resource papers, articles, and videos calling for the U.S. to establish, quote, safe zones in Syria, something that can only be done through the use of military force. Some of the titles of these resources give you an idea of what's in store for the members of Congress for whom this list is intended. Waiting for Barack, Spineless in Syria, The Tide of War is Rising, What's Obama Going to Say? Lessons of Failure in Syria, and We Still Have a Chance to Get Syria Right, end quote. It seems that Obama may have gotten the message. On Monday, he warned Syria that it would face military intervention if there were signs that its arsenal of unconventional weapons was being moved or prepared for use. Who will be reading the signs? It was our Nobel Prize winner's first direct threat of force against Syria during the 18-month rebellion-turned-civil war, which the U.S. and its allies have encouraged and made no effort to stop. It's been generally conceded that one likely result of the fighting in Syria is the breaking up of the country into religious enclaves. This has been Israel's goal for all the Arab Middle East countries and was first expressed as an overall Israeli strategy by Oded Yinon of Israel's Foreign Affairs Ministry in a 1982 essay entitled A Strategy for Israel in the 1980s. And this remains Israel's objective in Syria is being openly expressed in the Israeli press. In Egypt, newly elected President Mohamed Morsi shook things up gracefully by gracefully retiring the two leading generals who had been running the country after the fall of Mubarak and nullifying the ruling they had made placing the army above the civilian government. What has created a stir in Washington and no doubt in Israel was a paper written by the newly appointed Egyptian chief of staff, General Segd said Keith Thalby, when he was a student at the U.S. Army War College. His 46-page strategy research report, published in March 2005, examined, quote, national security interests of the United States and policies that have established a permanent military presence in the Middle East and the interactions and consequences of existence in the region. End quote. And he recommended, quote, the permanent withdrawal of U.S. military forces from the Middle East and the Gulf and the pursuit of U.S. strategic goals in the region through socioeconomic means and the impartial application of international law, end quote. He also noted the security of the State of Israel is an inherent objective in the overall national security strategy of the United States. It's the author's opinion, however, that this objective often conflicts with other United States policies and goals in the Middle East, end quote. It seems that with the appointment of General Thalby as the Egyptian Army Chief of Staff, U.S. and Egyptian relations are going to be very interesting. Regular listeners to Takes on the World will recall my updates on the successful campaign to keep Walmart from expanding into a 24/7 full-service grocery store in the Airport Boulevard Shopping Center. That celebration of that victory was foreshortened by the employees of Ukiah and the country's supermarkets, who since then have had to face the efforts of Mendocino's three supermarket chains, Safeway's, Raley's, and Save Mart Lucky, to cut their wages and benefits. This morning, before I get Marjorie Cohn on the phone to talk about Agent Orange in Vietnam, I'm going to play for you a short introductory segment from Union of Food and Commercial Workers Local President Ron Lynn, town meeting by phone with Safeway workers, a short message from Lynn to Lucky workers, and close with an interview I made yesterday with longtime Lucky worker Tara McMillan. So let's start with Ron Lynn.
We chose to do the Safeway town hall tonight because, as you probably know, much of the activity has been centered around the other two large employers, Raley's and Save Mart. Those two companies have been much more provocative than your company, terminating contracts, threatening to implement terms without member approval, and so on. Safeway, on the other hand, has continued to negotiate, slowly, to be sure, but without attempting to create a crisis or threaten our members. And while we continue to resist many of Safeway's proposals to change your contract, their demands for concessions have been nowhere near as drastic as those proposed by Save Mart and Raley's. Nevertheless, we wanted to take this opportunity to update you tonight because the process has taken so long and because, for various reasons, some incorrect information has begun to percolate in some of the stores. So let me anticipate one question. Why is this taking so long? Believe me, I feel your frustration on that one. It has been a long process, not only for you, but for those of us that have been involved in these negotiating sessions. So the reason is, first of all, contracts going well beyond expiration has become the norm for most unions in recent years because of the ongoing impact of the financial crisis, the slow economy, healthcare uncertainty, and other factors. We've seen this not only for UFCW members, but for hospital workers, Teamsters, government employees, nurses, and others. But more specifically for us, it's just plain complicated. You know, in the past, as you know, we bargained with all the major employers together. For various reasons, after initially being together, the companies this time split up, causing us to try to schedule different negotiation dates with each company, and that's an ongoing challenge. The logistics around meetings with your company are complicated further by the fact that Safeway's chief negotiator is also negotiating with other UFCW locals in other parts of the country. The other major factor is health care. And we're working very hard to create a plan design that fits within the hourly contribution that we can get from the employers, while continuing to provide affordable health care to our members and our retirees. That involves more than just bargaining. We have to do studies. We have to project costs. We have to estimate savings or increased costs based on different plan design changes that we're looking at. We also have to meet with and interview and analyze various benefit providers, and in the case of some, negotiate with them over their rates. There are multiple people involved in this. We have our benefits consultants. We have actuaries. The company has benefit consultants and actuaries. There's attorneys involved. All this is part of a process, and it just takes a tremendous amount of time, especially these days. And then add to all this the uncertainty created by the Supreme Court's upholding of the Affordable Care Act, and it gets a lot more complicated. We really don't know what the impact is going to be in 2014 and then beyond into 2016 when the exchanges go into effect and a lot of the other parts of the Affordable Care Act take hold. It could have an impact not only on our trust funds but on the cost of health care overall, and we have to try to make our estimates and our benefit projections with that in the back of our minds.
And that was Ron Lynn speaking to Safeway workers at a town hall meeting on the phone. Here's a message he has to Lucky workers.
This is Local 5 President Ron Lynn with an update for our members working at Lucky and Save Mart. Yesterday, I and the other union negotiators met with the UFCW National Bargaining Director to discuss strategy for bringing negotiations with your company to a successful conclusion. Later in the day, we had a brief and informal meeting with the company to express the concerns of our members and to request an additional bargaining session. We gave the company several available dates over the next 10 days, and we are awaiting their response. We also warned the company that any effort to implement the rejected proposed settlement without approval of our members would result in swift action by the union. Ultimately, our members will have another opportunity to vote on a proposed package. Until then, we'll keep you up to date on new developments and continue to work to assure that your rights and working conditions are protected. In the meantime, if you have any questions or concerns, please contact your Local 5 union representative. Thanks.
And that was Ron Lynn, the message to Lucky Workers, owned by Save Mart. And then here is an interview I made yesterday with Tara McMillan, who is a worker at Lucky. So let's hear Tara, her view. Tara, what is the situation in terms of negotiations with Save Mart, the owner of Lucky, from a worker's perspective at Lucky?
Well, Jeff, my understanding is that they have gone back into negotiations. Our contract was voted on, and it was voted over 60% against. Not enough for a strike vote, but enough to avoid it from going through. So they're back at the tables right now.
You've been working without a contract since last September, a year now?
Correct.
And I understand that the owner is demanding concessions from the Lucky employees?
Yes.
What kind of concessions have they been demanding?
They want us to give up a lot of our benefits that we currently have. For holiday, paid holidays. Here they want to take away Sunday pay. They want to take away night premium pay. They want to basically not pay for retirees anymore. And they want to impose 4 10-hour days instead of the 8-hour, 5 days a week. And those are just, you know, a list of things. There are more things that are more involved that they want us to do. But basically, where we stand right now, we're fighting to keep what we have, because once we lose it, it's been nearly impossible to get it back.
So with 4 10-hour days, that would mean if you worked, that would eliminate the overtime that would come after normal 8-hour day.
Correct, right. They don't want to pay overtime unless you achieve 40 hours a week. You exceed 40 hours a week, and then they'll pay you that overtime, but not until then.
So the employees of all the Lucky stores and Save Mart stores, which the owner took a vote and voted 60% for a strike, but 66% I think is necessary to have a strike. Is that correct?
You know, I'm not quite sure what the number is, the percentage is. I thought it was higher in the 90 percentile.
Oh, yeah.
But it didn't go through at all, which is a good thing.
It seems that all the supermarkets in Ukiah or in Northern California are all
in negotiations and all fighting back to maintain benefits. And so this is something that's going to be decided, I suppose, in the next few weeks with further negotiations.
Yes, it is. From my understanding, Safeway is waiting to see what we do as lucky employees, what we do with the contract negotiations, whether we agree on the next one that they present or not. Safeway usually follows suit, and then thereafter, Raley's does the same. Last year, we all negotiated together, but this year, each separate corporation has decided to go through negotiations separately.
I guess the idea is to divide and conquer.
I guess so. I hope it works.
Well, I hope it works for the workers, not for the owners.
Right.
Well, Tara, thanks very much for giving us an update, and we'll be checking back with you.
And that was Tara McMillan from Lucky's, and we'll be keeping an update on those negotiations with the supermarkets in the near future. I want to go back a bit to the story I had earlier about the supermarkets and their efforts to curtail the benefits and wages of their workers. And there are some documents online about negotiations at Raley's. Raley's and Lucky's seem to be much harder line, and Raley's particularly. And Raley's did take a strike vote as employees in Northern California. And Raley's employees, some of them are wondering why they haven't gone on strike since they took a strike vote. And the union responded. On May 25th, Raley's declared we had reached an impasse in negotiations. This move was not based in fact. It was intended to allow the company to implement its demands without union members having any say in the matter. Now we have the authority to strike if Raley's management decides to go that route, and so far the company has not decided to impose its terms, which indicates the union's decision to call the strike vote was a good one. And the question was, how close are the workers are striking at Raley's? And the answer, while the members have authorized a strike, the company has not moved to implement its last best and final offer, and that move would clearly require action against the employer. The union is setting up picket captain meetings, so they're prepared for any eventuality. And a question came, what's new about Raley's now? Why is this happening? And the union responded, rather than sit down with us to find mutually acceptable solutions, Raley hired Bob Tiernan, a longtime Republican Party activist, an individual with no history of bargaining in the grocery industry, and his stock and trade is fear-mongering, according to the union, and trying to defeat solidarity by intimidating workers. He's had countless unfair labor practices charged against him, according to the union, at the National Labor Relations Board. Until he's gone, until Raley's takes a more practical approach to bargaining, this level of acrimony will probably continue. That's according to the union. We have advised Raley's managers they are violating federal law by following Turnin's instructions, and many unfair labor practices have been filed by Local 5 in conjunction with Local 8, and investigations and more charges are continuing. In the past, the union notes, negotiations with Raley's have tended to be harmonious, but this time the atmosphere has been toxic, both in the stores and the bargaining table. And in explaining why the situation has changed so radically, the union officials say the CEO of Raley's, Mike Teal, hired this fellow, Bob Turnin, as senior vice president for labor relations. And he says, putting aside what you may or not think about politics, this is the union position, It is a stated policy of the Republican Party to destroy unions, both public and private. Of course, this is Jeff Blankford speaking. We've seen that in Wisconsin, Ohio, Indiana. There's no question about the anti-union policies of the Republican Party. As a former state Republican Party chair, they write, Turnin is a general in that fight, not a mere soldier. Despite Turnin's protest in the Sacramento Bee that he's not a union buster, his behavior as a high-priced management consultant at Berkeley Bowl, where it says the union, proved beyond doubt that he is in fact a union buster. What does that mean? At Berkeley Bowl, he was hired to come in and intimidate and coerce employees to vote against their own self-interest. This is according to the UFCW statement. After the decertification of the union took place, the workers at the Berkeley Bowl have few rights on the job and certainly not seniority. A grievance procedure, good benefits, pension, health, and welfare, retiree medical available to everyone at an affordable rate. Kiernan's efforts, they say, to get the members there to vote against the union ruined their jobs but lined his pockets. Reilly's behavior in these negotiations has been erratic, antagonistic, and often nonsensical. Morale is falling in the stores, and the Reilly's brand has been tarnished in the eyes of the public. That's according to the union. And from the time, they say, we sat down with Reilly's last September, the union bargaining committee has been level-headed, patient, creative, and open-minded. We've produced dozens of solutions to help Reilly's control costs and reclaim market share. At the same time, we have addressed the real and legitimate needs of the union workforce. Our ideas have been rejected out of hand without any original ideas proposed by Reilly's negotiators. This is obviously not a recipe for progress. I will be trying to get someone from Reilly's to respond to this on the next program or future program. I might even have that for part of next week's open lines if they're up to that. The time is now 9:54. We have about 5 minutes to go. If you have any comments on this situation, you can call here at 895 or 2448, or any comments that you have on what Professor Marjorie Cohn had to say about Agent Orange. One of the things that, as someone who actually was very active in the war in Vietnam, against the war in Vietnam, I was disturbed, as I indicated, to speak with Professor Cohn, that after the war, many people in the anti-war movement gathered together and celebrated their great victory over the forces of evil represented by the war makers in Washington. But then, immediately thereafter, there became divisions in the movement and attacks on the new Vietnamese government, which did make mistakes. Unfortunately, those mistakes have increased because without reparations and any demand by the anti-war movement that the United States pay reparations to Vietnam, and with the collapse of their major supporter, the Soviet Union, Vietnam has become subject to the dictates of the world market, the IMF and the World Bank, and now Vietnamese workers are a source of cheap labor competing for the cheapest labor in the world. And this is one of the great tragedies. One of the problems here, we're so far away from some real world problems that when they're out of sight, they're out of mind. We see recently in South Africa, and I have not done a program on South Africa in a long time, actually since my friend Dennis Brutus died, the great South African poet, who was on Robben Island with Nelson Mandela, but who became a very sharp critic of the South African government after the African National Congress took power, because so many of its former leaders became millionaires. I remember one, the union leader, Cyril Ramaphosa, who I met in Oakland at the Third World Liberation Front meeting. He was one of the major union leaders, the Transport Workers Union, and he became a member of the board of De Beers Diamond Industry, and he became Sir Comrade Cyril, a millionaire making money from the diamond mines. And we saw just last week a massacre by the South African military, shooting down, killing 18 workers, mine workers, in an episode reminiscent of the attack in Soweto. But this is being done by the African National Congress government. And actually, they're blaming the workers. Sound familiar? So I'm going to try and come up with a program, find someone to talk to about South Africa in the near future. But the anti-apartheid movement after Mandela was freed and came into power, again, that dissipated. And so South Africa becomes off the agenda. It's a problem we have being so far away from much more difficult realities than we see here in Mendocino County. Oh, very quick, you're on the air. Hello?
Just a reminder, there's a lot of real hard realities going on also in Mendocino County that don't seem to be seen.
I know that, but at this point in time, we're fortunate we're not being shot down and being chemically foliated, at least at this point in time. It might be, we are going to have drones. We do have drones beginning here.
Yeah. But anyway, I just mean the invisible individuals.
Oh, no, I know individuals, but I'm trying to say there's other realities around the world that we fortunately haven't experienced here. People experience suffering, economic suffering, everywhere in the globe, and including Mendocino County, but not on the scale that people experience in Vietnam or South Africa. That's what
and
I was trying to say.
I'm not necessarily talking about economic suffering. I'm just, it's just a cautionary thing.
Okay,
know?
I appreciate that. Thank you.
Okay,
actually, we're now coming to the end of the program. I want to say